Schloss Adler, the castle of the eagles. Believe me, it's well made. Because only an eagle can get to it. Our job is to get inside there and get him out as soon as possible.
Major Berkholder, my adjutant.
Read on, go!
Colonel Weissner, team security. Major von Hafen, Gestapo.
Allow me to introduce myself. Major Johann Schmidt, SS Military Intelligence, Stuttgart.
Richard Burton.
Take your clothes off. Don't argue. Take your clothes off.
Hello?
Clint Eastwood.
Now with McPherson dead, there's only five of us left. So you either let me know what's going on, or there's only going to be four.
From the company that brought you The Dirty Dozen, and the author who gave you The Guns of Navarone, Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood.
Lieutenant, drop that gun.
What?
Drop that gun and sit down.
What the hell are you talking about?
Where eagles dare.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and it's time for the fourth episode in the Iron Maiden series. We've made it to their album, Peace of Mind, and joining me for this episode is author DX Ferris.
Hello.
Hey. Yeah, you've written a couple books about Slayer, and you have a webcomic called Suburban Metal Dad, and I saw your online bio says you've written for AV Club, Rolling Stone, Alternative Press, Village Voice. So that's a pretty good list.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get around a little bit.
And, of course, you're also featured at the end of Neil Daniel's awesome book, Killers, awesome Iron Maiden book. You've got almost a page at the end. He's got a section called Metalheads Talk Maiden.
I'm partial to the early stuff, yeah, as I'm sure we'll talk about at some point. But Iron Maiden is... or was an important band to me at one point, certainly at this point that we're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
So thanks for having me. This is a great show you have. I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, when I was a teenager, there wasn't really anything cooler than Iron Maiden, you know, in the 80s as a teenager. They were kind of, yeah. They weren't my favorite band, like, just because Kiss existed, I guess. But, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I had all the posters and shirts and everything. What's interesting here now, this is the third album in a row where Iron Maiden have a lineup change. It's basically, yeah, I mean, every album up to this point, they have a lineup change. Now they're going to stay consistent, a consistent lineup for the next four records. But, you know, you had Adrian Smith was new on Killers. And then, of course, Bruce was new on Number of the Beast. And now on Peace of Mind, they changed drummers. Clive Burr is out. He has a pretty similar story to Paul Di'Anno, where he either fired or he quit, and it depends on who was talking about it which day, whether he fired or he quit. But and substance abuse, and
Yeah, conflicting stories in a rock and roll history. Go figure.
Yeah. But yeah, apparently he'd become the same as Deano. He was drinking too much and was unreliable in terms of touring. And
I wasn't there. I don't know.
Right. But,
I mean, this is, we can agree, the classic lineup, right?
Yeah, I mean, Clive Burr was awesome, but yeah, this is, at this point, yeah, this is what everyone would consider the classic lineup, I suppose, especially since they're going to make four albums together, which are probably the four, well, Number of the Beast is a pretty big deal, but these next four albums were their most successful, like, this was their biggest time in the U.S., at least, as far as visibility and popularity, so... Number of the Beast, of course, was number one record in the UK, but it was not as big in the US as Peace of Mind was definitely kind of when they became a lot more popular in the United States. So, yeah.
Right. Now, this one hit, was it number three in the UK? So technically not as big, but still very very respectable performance. Yes. Number three.
Yeah. And it went to 14 in the 14. US. So
yeah. The first platinum one in the US. All the other ones would catch up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, this is their grand entrance into national consciousness in the United States.
Yeah, and it was also my introduction to the band, just because this is the tape that my uncle had when I was a kid, and seeing that cover and putting it on, it wasn't like anything I had heard really at the time. So, yeah, this was a huge record for me, just in terms of, I guess, the evolution of my taste in music and everything. This was big. A big moment in my life was hearing this album, for sure.
Yeah, now I am, you know, for context, I'm 43 years old, so we're basically, you know, essentially the same age, same generation.
Yeah, I'm 42.
So this was the album that was current when I started listening to metal. You know, I don't remember a time in my life before the Number of the Beast poster. You know, it was just always kind of there. Like the sun or the moon in the sky, like Number of the Beast. And this was current. And Power Slave was the first one that I experienced as a brand new record, you know?
Yeah.
But this is the first one that was contemporary for me.
As far as I can remember, by the time I heard this, Power Slave was probably out, but this is the only one my uncle had. And my mom would drag me to my grandma's house every weekend. And my uncle still lived with her, and I would just listen to his tapes. He had all these metal tapes. He was a big Kiss fan. So, yeah, I just, my first exposure to stuff was just whatever my uncle had at the time.
So you had the cool uncle. That was your trajectory.
Yeah.
See, I grew up in a college town, so we had a metal show.
Right. Yeah, so I was the oldest. I was the oldest. I didn't have like an older brother or anything. So it was, but my uncle was my mom's youngest sibling, and he was, I mean, he was probably still in his maybe early 20s when I was a teenager, so we were kind of closer. And yeah, he had lots of heavy metal. He was into all this stuff like Quiet Riot and Dokken and all that kind of stuff at the time. So, and that's what I ended up being into as well. Nice. So,
see, I feel like I was kind of born with a genetic predisposition to be a Maiden guy. Like my dad was a medievalist. He loved British culture. So I grew up hearing like King Arthur as a bedtime story, you know, the tale of Gawain and the Green Knight, that kind of stuff. I grew up watching Monty Python. I lived in Britain for like a year when I was in second grade. I've been to a lot of the World War II museums in Britain. As a third grader, I could have named you a lot of old British aircraft and planes.
Yeah.
I'm an English major, so the British canons, all the different ones, from poetry to books, that's part of my DNA. And you know, I really love that Maiden balance of blue-collar metal, classical English highbrow education, and the comic book aesthetic that they brought to it, you know. So Maiden's comic book streak appealed to me, but so did their erudite, literate tradition too.
Yeah, and that all really explodes on Peace of Mind in terms of all the different references to so many. There are these, almost every song in the album is inspired by some poem or a book or movie or whatever. Yeah, there's a lot of different touchstones that they they really start hitting in their songwriting. I mean, Steve Harris was doing it earlier, but Peace of Mind is definitely far nerdier, I would say, than their earlier stuff had been. And I think Bruce Dickinson could definitely contributed to the nerdiness of it too. But
yeah, absolutely. That combo of the intellectual, you know, quote unquote intellectual stuff, but appreciated through the prism of the comic book aesthetic and the Eddie mythos, you know, that's where I live, that combination of stuff. I mean, I suppose technically I'm educated. You know, I've been to school for a while, but my dad was not a pretentious guy. You know, he didn't think he was special. He just knew that he had read a lot of things. And if you don't have that kind of background, you can get a true education by following the stuff that Iron Maiden talks about, you know, the references in this, you know, in the pre-internet days. I don't think most of the people listening to this podcast need a lecture about what it was like to live without the internet. But if you had six albums, you know, and two of those were Motley Crue and a couple were Judas Priest and two were Iron Maiden albums, this is the Iron Maiden album, or this is the album, if you have six tapes, that is going to take you away to someplace. You know, this is the one that you can put your headphones on and listen to the lyrics and be transformed. And if you take the time to really follow it, like, that leads you to questions like, who is Alfred Lord Tennyson? Dune, what is that? Frank Herbert, who's that guy? Musashi, what is that? So again, pre-internet, this points you in a lot of different directions. And if you didn't grow up with a dad telling you that's who this is, you know, more so than a lot of metal bands, this is a real educational opportunity.
Yeah, that's the real dichotomy of Iron Maiden is people in the know are aware of, for one thing, how great they are at their art form and how this truly is art, what they're doing, and also how intelligent it is and thoughtful and creative and all that stuff. But then people who aren't in the know and don't appreciate heavy metal probably just think Iron Maiden is a bunch of morons making music for idiots, you know?
So, yeah, and, you know, in my world, you know, growing up, again, with an internationally ranked Chaucer scholar in the house who went to Harvard, to me, like, it's all the same thing. My dad didn't really distinguish between high and low culture. Well, he did a little bit more than I did, but I think it's all the same thing. You know, the Trooper and the stuff of the Eddie mythos and the ongoing tale of however you choose to interpret the comics or the album covers. To me, that's the same thing as the Alfred Lord Tennyson poetry. We're all trying to get at kick-ass, gnarly shit, you know?
Yeah.
And it's one thing to sit back and take a pompous tone and say, well, Alfred Lord Tennyson is really a sublime poet and captures this astonishing imagery. And it's really quite sublime and transcendent. And screw that. You know, it kicks ass. That's a kick-ass poem. And so is The Trooper. The Trooper is a kick-ass song. You know, in my world, there's not a tremendous difference between ballet and the WWF. I'm old enough to call it WWF. We're all trying to get at the same visceral charges. You know, we're all trying to have the same kind of fun. We're all looking at art and saying, essentially, this is cool. This is amazing. That takes me somewhere. And you can pretend and be phony and say, wow, that really, it's classic imagery they're tapping here. Or you can just go, ah, Iron Maiden, that kicks ass. That's amazing. Yeah, Eddie. It's all the same thing, and I think it's all valuable. And to have that come together in a big ball of one of your favorite bands, that's rare, you know?
Yeah, well put. So so Clive Burr's out, and enter this guy, Michael Henry McBrain, who got the name Nicky. I guess it started as Nicky because he had a teddy bear named Nicholas. But it became it became Nico when one of his drunken bandmates mispronounced it, and then they just started calling him Nico.
Yeah, I love the British tradition of how one word just mutates into another. You know, yeah. Steve Harris, famously known as Ari.
Yeah.
Like, wow. Yeah, you had to be there. Like, even this album title itself, Peace of Mind, they can't even remember exactly where it came from. Everybody was drunk, somebody said it, and now that was the thing.
Right. Nico was
Nico.
Yeah, Nico was in a band called the Streetwalkers with Roger Chapman. Roger Chapman had a band called Family that they were kind of a bluesy prog, British prog band. I know Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick was a big fan. I'm not a huge fan of Family. I've listened to them probably mainly because Rick Nielsen liked them. But Streetwalkers was more of kind of a rock band. He kind of took out a lot of the... I didn't research this, so I hope I'm remembering the guy from Family's name right. I think it's Roger Chapman. And then, so Nico was in that band, and then he played with Pat Travers. But the path that leads him to Maiden was when he joined a French metal band called Trust. And that band, of course, is most famous because, well, at least to us, yeah, because Anthrax covered Antisocial, which that record was before Nico joined, so he didn't play on it. You know, Antisocial, but he joined the band a little later. And the really funny thing is the guy that replaced Nico McBrain in Trust when he left to join Iron Maiden was Clive Burr. So that reminded me of when Trujillo and Newsted basically traded places, I think, right? Ended up in Ozzy's band. Then, it's funny that Clive Burr and Nico did the same thing, pretty much.
Yeah, and Nico has a jazz background. You know, one of the, if I understand correctly, you know, jazz is one of the things that really got him interested. And much like Dave Lombardo from Slayer, he, you know, on countless thousands of other drummers, I'm sure, used to bang on pots and pans and whatever he could grab.
Yeah.
But he's a jazz guy, is where he kind of comes from. And some of my... I think the best metal players have a jazz background. You know, Sabbath was jazz and blues famously. The Megadeth Peace Sells lineup, jazz fusion, that stuff is absolutely lethal. And it just works with metal. I don't know why, but it does.
Yeah, we talked on the Number of the Beast episode, we were talking about how the differences between Clive Burr and Nico, how Clive Burr, it seems like he was more of a spontaneous... rock, unpredictable rock type drummer, and Nico is more of a precise kind of drummer, which makes sense. But I mean, it was interesting when I saw that he's completely self-taught, never had a lesson, and yet you look at him as more of a, I don't know, professional, serious, maybe studio musician type guy.
Yeah, as classical opposed to, style drummer.
Yeah, as opposed to Clive Burr was more of a just, I don't know.
And maybe this is a tribute to his confidence. I never thought he stood out much as a drummer in, you know, the way that, like, Dave Lombardo, again, you know, had some kind of famous spotlight moments. I think his main contribution is holding it down. You know, I'm not minimizing his skill as a drummer. I think he's amazing. But the fact that he doesn't show off much and just services the whole song and plays in absolute lockstep with everybody else. And within that, he does some amazing things, but he's not a show-offy drummer, great as he is. Well, you know, I'll tell you, I'll give you my context for Iron Maiden. I had, as I said, at one point, I was a huge Iron Maiden fan. You know, anybody alive on the planet listening to metal should have been. They're not so important to me right now. You know, certainly we can discuss where they are in the all-time metal bands. They're one of them. But for me, I turned my back on them at a certain point. And I'll tell you why. At least half of what is wrong with me stems from me going to Catholic school, or, you know, more precisely, being sent to Catholic school, where my parents thought I would get a better education, but I did not. But it was a useful frame of reference. It was a useful frame of reference. If you're going to be an English major, if you're going to study literature, movies, that kind of stuff, biblical imagery comes up a lot, mythology, all that kind of things, myths, metaphors, allusions, symbols. The Catholic Bible thing, it's a useful frame of reference. The Catholics, I think this goes back to medieval theology, have a concept called the sin of the spirit. There's a much better term for it in medieval theology. I can't think of what it is offhand, but in more modern terms, it's called the sin of the spirit. And basically, once you do it, you are damned. Your soul is damned to hell for all eternity. Doesn't matter what you do, what good deeds you do, how you try to redeem yourself. You messed up so badly that your soul is going to hell. Now, as someone who was a Catholic as a kid, like many of us, I'm not a Catholic anymore. I don't think that's how it works necessarily. I have my own ideas about the afterlife and eternity. But as somebody that likes the idea of accountability, you know, as somebody who has something of a romantic streak and likes to imagine that what you do matters, I like the idea of the sin of the spirit. You have messed up so badly that you are forever written off. Again, I don't think that's how life and death and the afterlife necessarily works, but I like that idea, the sin of the spirit. You follow me?
Yeah.
So in like 19, I spent the 80s going to arena concerts a lot, you know, spending all of my paper out money, you know, bucking up $12.75 at a time to go see shows. And over the course of the mid-80s, I started to get increasingly bored with it. You know, I was discovering punk, discovering hardcore, and the shows were getting longer and longer and more tradition-bound. You know, every song would get a couple minutes longer live. You know, they would do long intros that would take them 2 minutes to end the song. You know, they'd have to hit the drums and brrr, and boom, 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 and wind up the guitars and bum, dun, dun. Ooh, thank you, thank you. And they catch their breath for a minute. And as I was discovering punk rock, like in hardcore, like DRI, Agnostic Front, you could go see those bands and you're right there in the club with them. You know, if you're not careful, you're going to get pushed onto the stage and the guitarist is going to knock you in the head with his knee, you know?
Yeah.
So as I was learning to enjoy and find the punk experience, I was going to arenas and being a whole hockey rink away from other bands. And that was becoming boring to me. You know, and Iron Maiden ultimately is the band that killed arena rock for me. After Iron Maiden, I could no longer enjoy an arena show. And the specific thing that did that to me was Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Now, later on, we can talk about where this fits into the Iron Maiden mythology and the evolution of their art. But that song, essentially a 15-minute song that they did on the Power Slave tour. You know, they recorded it for the Power Slave album and... long song, you know, and it has an intellectual tradition and it was ambitious and it was arty, you know, fine, whatever. And they played it on the Power Slave tour. And I guess if you got to go pee, that's okay. You know, that's an interesting part of the live show. But that's not what I wanted to see in a concert at that point. When I finally got to, when they finally released Led Zeppelin's The Song Remains the Same on videotape and I got that 27-minute Dazed and Confused. Oh, you know, I understand the significance of that, but that's boring, man. I don't want that. When I'm sitting in an arena, I don't want a 15-minute live track, right? I don't want a song stretched out to 20 minutes live. I don't want that. I don't want that at all. But I understand how it was a sign of artistic integrity that they recorded it, they were committed to it, they played it. But then a couple years later with Somewhere in Time, you know, Maiden and Priest were doing an admirable job of keeping pace with the thrash metal that they had inspired. You know, by 87, I was very much a Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer person, but I was still, I still respected my heroes, you know. And then Maiden, for the second tour in a row, I mean, what was the first single from Somewhere in Time? Wasted Years. That song was, in theory, a moshable song. You could have had a circle pit to that song. So I go see Maiden live, and two tours in a row, second tour in a row, I get Rime of the Ancient Mariner. for 20 minutes. I just got to sit there and... Oh, how he danced the Ancient Mariner. Nobody knows who he was or what he was doing or why he shot that bird. Oh, who cares? And that killed Arena Rock for me. I don't think I went to another arena show in the 80s. So that was kind of, to me, that was Iron Maiden's Sin of the Spirit. I turned my back on them. They were never important to me again. And they rebounded, and they were significant, and they did great things, and they're one of the all-time greats, but I could just never care about them after the hubris of playing that 20-minute song two tours in a row. So that's my tale. That is my 20-minute tale of being an Iron Maiden fan. And if you think that's boring, that's what they did to me, and that's why they didn't matter to me after a certain point. But peace of mind, this is when I deeply cared about the band. I think that this album is the one where, like, what we think of as Iron Maiden crystallizes and gels.
Right.
Like, yeah. What Iron Maiden would become famous as, this is it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And, like, I call it Iron Maiden song bingo or Iron Maiden song checklist, where there's a series of, like, subjects and things to reference in the title that we think of as Iron Maiden. Musically, there's like six of them. There's the real fast ripper, I call them, something like The Trooper or Aces High, you know, the really super fast song that theoretically, as I said, you can mosh to. There's that. You got the song that is a little bit too long later on. You know, you see the roots of it here, like we got some 7-minute songs, 6-7. But later on, you get Rime of the Ancient Mariner. You get Angel and the Gambler, that is, what, a 10-minute single? Okay, whatever, guys. You got, like, the proggy song, you know, Where Eagles Dare, which is a really ballsy way to start an album, I think. You got the epic sing-along. In this case, it's Die With Your Boots On. Then you have, like, the sort of sub-ripper, the fastish song that's not as good. You know, the song that's kind of 2 minutes to midnight, to the aces high. You know, still fast, still heavy, still going hard, but not quite as mosh-worthy, you know. And subjects and title-wise, I mean, you got a reference to Eagles. You got to have that. True history, so something like Alexander the Great. Vague history, something like Power Slave, where, you know, Egypt, whatever. You know, I'm like a pharaoh and shit, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You got to have, like, movie references in there. And that's good. You know, that's not bad. You know, I'd rather the bands write songs about movies than just make up some bullshit about their love life, you know. So writing a song about a movie is usually a good scene, you know. If the movie worked, you're talking about it. It's a good story, you know. Book, you know, always something about a book. You know, if you're borrowing the title, write a song about the book. That's good. Maiden do that a lot. Epic poem. I don't know if you want to include that in the same literary tradition, but Maiden are good for that. Rime of the Ancient Mariner, The Trooper. A common phrase like Die With Your Boots On or Fear of the Dark. Those always make good album or song titles. You know, those are recognizable phrases. Some kind of gnarly Bible verse. You know, that's always good. Revelations in this case. Some sort of battle scenario. We got that with The Trooper, certainly. Some kind of sci-fi something. We'll talk about that later. And World War II, definitely. You got to go out of your way for a World War II song. So that's, to me, that's the Iron Maiden song bingo checklist. And I think you get pretty much all those here in some way, shape, or form, as you would Forevermore.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah, everything but the kitchen sink kind of on peace of mind as far as cultural references and things.
But it works. I mean, this is a cinematic album, man. I mean, this is a movie. You know, put on your headphones, listen away. It'll take you somewhere.
Yeah, Iron Maiden were the kind of band where, you know, if you started listening to them when you were young enough, then you're learning things in school and you're like, oh, that's where that Maiden song is from, or that's what that Maiden song is about, you know. So Peace of Mind was recorded in the Bahamas at Compass Point Studios, which that's where Back in Black was recorded, I think, and probably a lot of other stuff.
Yeah, but, I'll go there.
Yeah. They recorded it February to March of 1983. So February, March, that's probably why they wanted to go to the Bahamas. It was a lot nicer there than in England. February, March, 83, they recorded it, released it in May. So I love the fast turnaround you used to have with records, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like what's their run? Like Number of the Beast was 82. This is 83. Power Slave was 84.
Yep, yeah.
And, I mean, Somewhere in Time was like 86, but it's not like they stopped for a couple years. You know, they were touring the whole time. So, yeah, like.
And they put out the live album in between. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this industry standard thing of 5 years between albums, that's some horse shit, you know?
Yeah, it's
get your reps, guys. You know, of course you can't write songs. You're making an album every 5 years.
Yeah. And I guess the album title originally comes with the cover concept, I think. The idea of Eddie getting a lobotomy, I think that's where everything starts. And then they had the original title was Food for Thought. I don't know how serious they were about that title or if it was just kind of a holding position until they came up with the real title. But I think it all started with the idea of Eddie getting a lobotomy. I think that's where the whole concept began with. It didn't start with the title, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's how I understand it. They had the concept of Eddie being lobotomized and then Food for Thought. And then, you know, the legend says that they were all drunk at the pub and somebody, nobody will take credit for it, you know, to their credit. You know, everybody wants to credit somebody else. Somebody said peace of mind, like P-I-E.
Yeah.
They said, that's it, mate.
Yeah.
What is your take on Eddie? Do you see all the covers as being part of one story?
Yeah, pretty much.
Like, I never actually pieced it together, but, you know, in my comic book mind that can, like, kind of be selective about continuity, I see it as all one guy. I don't know if he's immortal or what, but, yeah, that's him. This is all part of his epic.
Yeah, I don't know where the Power Slave cover fits into the storyline. You know, I mean...
Yeah, maybe time travel, maybe he's eternal, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, time travel.
But that's Eddie, that's him.
So he traveled back in time and then he travels forward in time to somewhere in time. Okay. And Seventh Son definitely looks like a very futuristic environment wherever he is. So
yeah, maybe he's like the Vampire Lestat, like he's been around for a long, long time and time traveled and this and that. But
and then yeah. on No Prayer for the Dying, when he's in the coffin, so I guess he's coming back to life and he's got the long hair again, right? So
well, not dead which eternal lie, BJ. Not dead which eternal lie.
But then Fear of the Dark, I don't know where that would fit into the storyline.
Yeah, you know, that's one of those, I think, kind of shameful episodes where it's not Derek Riggs' artwork, but who are you fooling? That's Derek Riggs' artwork.
Yeah, so it starts with the lobotomy concept. They end up with the title Peace of Mind. Then interesting that this is the only Blaze Bailey album that doesn't have a title track. Yeah,
that's a good point. Does the phrase appear in the lyrics anywhere?
I think, yeah, in Still Life, I think they say it. But yeah, I don't know if that was probably added after they had named the album, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so great album cover, but I mean, the Trooper poster. Did you have the Trooper poster?
I think I did, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's you know, arguably the number one piece of metal artwork. I might put it behind the Rain and Blood cover, but if you want to say it's the best, I won't argue that point too hard.
I guess Eddie is probably one of the reasons that certain people never took Iron Maiden seriously, maybe. But of course, Eddie was also such a huge marketing coup for the band. You know, as a teenager in the 80s, you know, everything Eddie, you just thought was awesome. And no other band really had that kind of you know, the character of Eddie was almost like a fifth band member. It was such a huge thing for the band and just so emblematic.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, in the 21st century, everybody's a marketer and we talk about branding, and I find that distasteful, but who has a better brand than Iron Maiden?
Yeah, it was really, and I don't think it was really conscious. I think it just kind of evolved and it kind of fell into their lap. They had this, you know, it evolved from the Eddie the Ed thing that they had on stage, and then they just put it on their album cover. But, you know, when it becomes this, you know, iconic kind of mascot, I definitely don't think they had that in mind at the beginning. It just kind of happened, just kind of worked out that way, I guess. But I mean,
yeah, I mean, does Eddie rank, you think, as the best metal mascot? I think so.
Yeah, he's got to be. When you see some of the other ones, some of the more obscure bands that tried to have mascots, it's pretty fun.
Yeah, I mean, I'll respect the Dio's Murray and Vic Rattlehead.
Yeah. And like the Quiet Riot guy with the mask.
Yeah. Yeah, he was there for a minute.
But then I think there's a band called Exhumer that had a guy that was just like a cross between Eddie and Quiet Riot guy or something. Like, yeah, Eddie with the mask on.
I liked Exciter's album covers, you know, some kind of killer zombie with a switchblade, whatever.
Yeah,
I like that idea. It doesn't always work, though. But I mean, Maiden imagery is the... In terms of imagery, Maiden is, I mean, let's face it, if Spinal Tap is a real band, it is Iron Maiden. And I say that with all respect, with the props and the content. I mean, if Spinal Tap, let's face it, if Spinal Tap did not feature that scene with the pods in Rock and Roll Creation, then there would, in fact, be a real-life video clip of Steve Harris or Adrian Smith getting his arm stuck in a pod. You know, it's only because Spinal Tap pretended to do that it didn't really happen.
And Eddie definitely contributes to the Spinal Tapishness elements to the Iron Maiden story. There's definitely, and Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, you know, stuff like that. There definitely are.
Nobody knows who Eddie was or what he was doing.
I was thinking that Eddie really kind of worked for Iron Maiden the same way the makeup worked for Kiss, as this kind of huge visual element to the band. That,
yeah, good point.
Yeah, and so
they didn't have to prostitute themselves out. You know, they never flirted with makeup, not for a second. You know, Bruce had his stage gear, but I think that was more of a fencing outfit almost, you know.
I guess your average band or your average album, the album cover doesn't really matter that much. You know, you probably don't pay a ton of attention to the album cover, but with Iron Maiden, it was such a huge part of the album, of what the album cover was going to be. It was very significant, so... Were-Eagles Dare, inspired by a 1968 World War II film starring Clint Eastwood and Richard
Ding,
Burton.
Ding, 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 if you're playing Iron Maiden, bingo. There you go.
Yeah,
movie and World War II at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. And Clint Eastwood and Iron Maiden don't really seem like they're in the same universe, but I guess it... But yeah, this is just an insanely epic song, with the arrangement is just over the top. There's so many great riffs.
Yeah, that's a very proggy song.
Yeah, but also so melodic. I mean, I think it has an amazing melody, and Bruce Dickinson is amazing on this song. So it's... I mean, right away, this is so different from most of Number of the Beast, because it's just massive guitars, crazy arrangement, riff after riff, you know, just a very ambitious song. And to me, I just think it's a masterpiece. I love this song.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, you talk about putting on your headphones and drifting away. This one takes you off, you know, those gun bursts, the sound effects, that's really subtly done. You know, it's not like beat you over the head with a moment. Really nicely done. Harris was a big King Crimson fan, and that's where that prog comes from. You know, I think a lot of Maiden's career, what defined them is something that they were influenced by and didn't do was their classic rock background. You know, the things that we consider classic rock now, with the guitar harmonies and the King Crimson stuff. And later on, I know it was important to Dickinson to try to record something in the vein of Cashmere. And I don't think that was good for them necessarily, but, you know, they did have that classic rock background and sometimes aspirations. Did it work? Not always, but it was there if you look for it. And certainly like the bonus tracks on this album, I don't know if you want to talk about them later, but the bonus tracks on the reissue, I guess the B-sides at the time, you know, you have a Montrose song and you have Jethro Tull. So sure. Yeah, Where Eagles Dare.
And this is also maybe one of the reasons to put this as the first song is it's a pretty good introduction to Nico McBrain because he's going all out on this song. It's the whole thing. Yeah, because it's kind of it's a proggy Maiden song, but it's also just heavy and fast paced and everything too. So
yeah, really holding it down. See, I'm a proponent of lead drums. You know, I think
The
drums should be further up in the mix. And this album is mixed in an interesting way. You know, Birch engineers and produces. And some of the aspects of the production are a little bit dated, but you can hear every single instrument. And I think that's important. And I think that's a lost art. And you can really hear what Nico is doing. But I wish he were a little bit more prominent in the mix.
Sure. Yeah, this is a really well-produced album, I think. But yeah, I can hear, I understand what you're saying about maybe, yeah, turn the drums up a little. Yeah, I love creative drummers with tons of fills. So the second song, Revelations, I mean,
ding, 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 biblical reference.
Yeah.
Reverent biblical reference. You know, I mean, so many in the 80s Christians would get up in arms about metal bands making biblical references, but Tony Iommi wasn't wearing a cross to be blasphemous. And, you know, this song is not saying like Revelations, like the devil and shit, man. But Revelation's very reverent. You know, it's interesting. Almost half of this album turns up on Live After Death. You know, 4 out of the 9 cuts on it turn up on it. And when I listen to this, like, with a lot of Maiden songs, like I didn't realize I listened to Live After Death that much, but when I hear the songs, I hear in my head the live version. Like I hear Bruce's stage banter. Revelations, I think of as the faster, heavier version from the live one. I like the studio one. I think it's an interesting contrast between the two, you know, that very classical, almost 70s space rock production. I like what they do with the echoing riff on it. But, you know, I when I think of the song, I think of the faster live version.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm not a big live album person, so I've never listened to Live After Death very much.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those rare live albums that almost works as a greatest hits.
Yeah, so the opening bit of Revelations is verbatim from a poem, or I guess it's also performed as a hymn, but written by G.K. Chesterton, who was a British writer and theologian. And then supposedly the rest of the song was based on the ideas of Aleister Crowley.
Ding, ding, ding. Aleister Crowley is definitely on the checklist.
Yeah. I don't know how much of a stretch that is. I don't know what... I didn't do any research about what the rest of Revelations has to do with the works of Aleister Crowley. That's what you see talked about. The song is credited solely to Bruce Dickinson as the author of the song. And I love the melody. This is one where I will sing along every word, you know. If I'm in the car, I'll be singing this song. I've heard it a lot, and I know every word, and it's a great melody to sing along with. But it's also pretty heavy. You know, another ambitious arrangement for this song, and I just think this is a great 1-2 punch to start off the record. I love both of these first two songs. You know, if you hear Where Eagles Dare, you're going to want to hear Revelations next. I think you got to listen to both, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, so the third song, just as good, but it's kind of a shift because it's more of, it's almost like Iron Maiden's pop, the pop version of Iron Maiden, I guess, sort of. Flight of Icarus.
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, this is where they're starting to dip their toes into the mythology a little bit more. You know, the story of Icarus flying too close to the sun, that is a wonderful myth and an enduring metaphor.
Yeah.
You know, again, if you didn't grow up in the house, you know, with myths and classical education, you know, this is a really interesting story to be exposed to. You know, it's a good explanation for like a lot of, yeah, you can apply it to anything. It's a valuable metaphor is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's a great, it's probably one of the coolest metaphors to come from Greek myth. It's just, yeah.
And this one written by Dickinson and Smith, you know, it's really good. As you mentioned, this album has pretty balanced songwriting contributions. Everybody, you know, the people that write songs are weighing in and working together.
Right. Yeah, it's funny how this song's, you know, it seems like a Steve Harris song, but he wasn't even involved. So that's interesting. But the myth of Icarus and Daedalus, Daedalus built the labyrinth for the Minotaur to be imprisoned in, but then they imprisoned Daedalus because he knew how to solve the labyrinth. I don't know if that's the basic summation of, so Daedalus and his son are imprisoned in this tower and they're, method of escape is to make these wings out of wax and feathers, but then even though he's warned not to, I think Icarus flies too close to the sun and melts.
Yeah, he says,
wings.
Hey, fly out of here, but be careful, don't go too close to the sun because that will melt the wax on the wings, they'll fall apart and you will be boned. Right. But he's up there and he says, hey, I'm flying high, I'm flying great, maybe I can even touch the sun.
Yeah.
You know, the Greeks, you know, in a nutshell, if we can learn one great lesson from ancient Greek culture, it is not to be extreme. You know, the Greeks cherished moderation, and Icarus went for the sun, and too close, the wax melted, the wings fell apart, and he escaped into death.
But I think it's in Neil Daniel's book where he kind of points out that the lyrics to the song seem to indicate that Daedalus is like, it says he's with the eyes of a madman, and he's kind of encouraging Icarus as if he's wants it. I don't know. You get the impression that he wants him to fly too close to the sun and fall because he's crazy. That's kind of the impression you get from the lyrics.
That's how they play it here.
Yeah.
And hey, this is heavy metal we're talking about. Yeah, go close to the sun.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And this, you know, this actually, like, you got the songs that turn up on Live After Death. Like, here's four of them in a row. Revelations, Icarus, Die With Your Boots, and The Trooper. All four of those, bam, 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 would turn up on, you know, what effectively was their greatest hits at the time.
Yeah, well, Flight of Icarus is obviously one of the most classic Maiden singles and just a great song, very melodic. Another just kind of ambitious song. They really went balls out on this record. Die With Your Boots On. It's funny that that's an American phrase. According to Wikipedia, it originates from frontier towns in the 19th century in the American West. It says it probably originally alluded to soldiers who died on active duty. But then it also says it was apparently first used in the late 19th century, talking about the deaths of cowboys and others in the American West who were killed in gun battles or hanged. I think eventually it just came to be a reference to somebody who was hanged. I think that's kind of how it ended up mainly being used. But I thought it was interesting that it's an American phrase that Iron Maiden used here. This is a cool song. I don't think it's nearly as good as the first three songs, in my opinion.
Yeah, this, if you're keeping track though, this is the epic sing along for the album.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, this is interesting in that stylistically, the production on this, you know, the British contributed much to culture and music, but the British did not perfect gang vocals.
Yeah.
So it's interesting in the studio version how it sounds like three guys in a booth saying, if you're gonna die, die with your boots on.
Yeah, I think there's a contrast between the first three songs and this song because the first three songs are so smart.
Epic, as the kids say.
Yeah, they're so epic and also literate and just,
elusive, we'll say.
Yeah, and then Die With Your Boots On is just kind of dumb. So yeah. Yeah.
They're using contractions at this point. If you're going to die.
Yeah. Yeah. And
but it works. You know, I remember the first couple times seeing them. That was awesome. If you're going to die, die with your boots on.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely a live, definitely a good live song for sure. More energetic and more like attitude, I guess. I guess there's attitude in this one. You wouldn't really describe any of the first three songs as having attitude. No point asking when it is.
Charge of the Light Brigade by Alfred Lord Tennyson, read by Patrick Wallace. Half a league, half a league, half a league onward, all in the valley of death, rode the 600. Forward, the Light Brigade, charge for the guns, he said. Into the valley of death rode the 600. Forward, the Light Brigade, was there a man dismayed? Not though the soldier knew someone had blundered. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die. Into the valley of death rode the 600. Cannon to right of them, cannon to left of them, cannon in front of them volleyed and thundered. stormed at with shot and shell, boldly they rode, and well, into the jaws of death, into the mouth of hell, rode the 600. Flashed all their sabres bare, flashed as they turned in air, sabring the gunners there, charging an army, while all the world wondered. Plunged in the battery smoke, right through the line they broke, Cossack and Russian reeled from the sabre stroke, shattered and sundered. Then they rode back, but not the 600. Cannon to right of them, cannon to left of them, cannon behind them, volleyed and thundered. Stormed at with shot and shell, while horse and hero fell, they that had fought so well came through the jaws of death, back from the mouth of hell, all that was left of them, left of 600. When can their glory fade? Oh, the wild charge they made, all the world wondered. Honour the charge they made, honour the light brigade, noble 600.
Flip the record over, and we get to obviously your favorite song on the album.
Yeah, you know, The Trooper, I think, is one of those songs that if you had to explain heavy metal to somebody, you could play that. You could play that and say, this is what heavy metal is. And they'd say, okay, I get it.
Yeah, I wrote down that, because I talked on the Number of the Beast episode, I talked about how Run to the Hills is, if you're looking at heavy metal as an art form, Run to the Hills is like a perfect example of what the art of writing a heavy metal song would be. But yeah, I wrote down that The Trooper, you know, if heavy metal songwriting is a true art form, then this song would be in the heavy metal Smithsonian. You know, it's like the ultimate, it's like as good as it gets. This is the art of writing a heavy metal song. The Trooper is pretty emblematic of what it's all about, and as good as it gets, really.
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, this has something that, you know, a lot of Maiden songs have going for them, in that it's a narrative. It tells a story, and it doesn't weigh down in the details necessarily of the who, what, where, when. But, you know, obviously, the literary roots of it is based on Alfred Lord Tennyson's, is it Charge of the Light Brigade?
Yeah.
So it has roots, but I mean, you can very much enjoy it and follow the story without knowing where it came from. And, you know, so many of these songs on the album, I think all of them, everything is pretty much a story.
Yeah, Charge of the Light Brigade was 1854 narrative poem about the Battle of Balaclava. I'm not sure how you pronounce that, during the Crimean War. And yeah, it's just it's basically a poem about soldiers on horses charging into battle, I think, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
Which, yeah, so, I mean, The Trooper is such a perfect, like, sonic representation of that concept. It's really amazingly well done. If Steve Harris was started with the idea of writing a song about Charge of the Light Brigade and then this came out, that's amazing. I wonder if that's how it happened, or if he wrote the song and then if he had the music first and then decided to make it, to base it on Charge of the Light Brigade because it had kind of a galloping feel or something.
Galloping is a perfect word for it.
So I would be fascinated to know if he started with, I'm going to write a song about Charge of the Light Brigade, and then this is what came out, or if the song, he wrote the music first and then decided to base it on that. That would be...
Yeah, like, I wonder when the riff came in.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the riff is so central to it. And this was, fans of metal lore and books and documentaries, I mean, this was the theme song to Heavy, the Story of Metal, that really good documentary series that ran on VH1 10 years ago now. Yeah. But I mean, if you're doing a documentary about the history of metal, how can you do better than this particular song? And this, you know, as you mentioned, was a Harris song. This was all him.
And it's a very different song, because you've got the chorus is just, whoa, it's just, you know, doesn't even have lyrics. And then also the guitar melody is practically the chorus. You know, it's like maybe the whoa is the bridge and then the guitar melody is the chorus. So it's a very different song. It's not a typically written song at all. It's,
you know, dare we say creative. You know, you're following the rules, but not.
Yeah, it's very creative, very singular. You know, there's no other band with songs like this.
Yeah, it's, I mean, as the kids say, that whoa is what the internet is up in arms about. They've discovered the millennial whoop. the whoa thing that, so famously applied by the Misfits and now a lot of more popular artists. Like, you can't go wrong with a whoa chorus.
Right. So, second song on side two, Still Life. Well, at the beginning of this song, there's the interesting backwards subliminal hidden message.
Yeah.
Which turns out it was just the band, making fun of the fact that at this point, I guess already at this point, 83, I'm not sure like when the Judas Priest trial happened, but it had to be after this.
Yeah, that was later.
Yeah, so this is even earlier than I thought that this kind of shit was going on, where bands were being accused of subliminal messages and being satanic and everything. But I guess already by this time it was going on, so they decided to make fun of that and put the this fake backwards message, which is really Nico McBrain doing an impression of Idi Amin.
They're mean, yeah.
So just completely ridiculous. But
yeah, and it sounds like earmuffs warning, kids. I thought it sounded like them saying fuck it backwards. Right. Fuck it forward.
Nothing anew. You need to be them blue. Snob if you need to be the soup. What wool said the thing with the three bonds? Good mel with thing you won't understand.
But yeah, so that's, I guess, what the backwards message here is all about. Just kind
so
of
I don't know if Still Life is the first going back, but I mean, this represents the Cthulhu mythos, however you want to pronounce it, the mythos of weird fiction, which was kind of alludes to a story that was not by H.P. Lovecraft, but the Cthulhoid mythos that kind of evolved out of H.P. Lovecraft's work. You know, H.P. Lovecraft, again, the writer that was referenced in the Life of Death Life After Death Tombstone, the horror writer that wrote That Is Not Dead, Which Can Eternal Lie, Yet With Stranger Eons. Metallica quoted that as well.
Yeah, I think I read that the guy that wrote the story, Inhabitant of the Lake, that this song is kind of based on, J. Ramsey Campbell, I think he was a mentor of H.P. Lovecraft, even. So Still Life is kind of a simple song in the context of a lot of the rest of the album, I guess. Kind of just a more straightforward poppy song.
14 years ago, 2001, A Space Odyssey was the astounding epic that aroused a generation, telling them where they might be headed. Now, 20th Century Fox presents a science fantasy adventure that will arouse this generation, telling us where we might have begun.
Quest for Fire. Yeah,
it's yeah, just... you know, that's the movie, technically book also.
Yeah.
I don't think the book inspired that one. And I don't know if it even inspired this one, because it starts off talking about dinosaurs, but the movie and book that this were based on were set 10,000 years ago, not when dinosaurs walked the earth. Right. But hey, you know, it's art. You're allowed.
Yeah, well, I guess it was a common misconception probably to connect cavemen and dinosaurs or something. I don't know.
Yeah, and I'm sure some of your listeners might say, no, that's wrong. The Earth is 5,000 years old, and
I hope not, Jesus, too many.
On the dinosaur.
Yeah.
So I wasn't there. I don't know. I could be wrong. But don't send an email to BJ. Don't be angry with him.
The entire scientific community could be wrong, I guess. Quest for Fire was a 1981 film about a Cro-Magnon tribe. Who their fire goes out. They have fire, but it goes out, and they don't know how to start a new one, so the three of them go on this quest for fire. And I remember that movie when I was a kid as being just insanely boring. Like, if it was on cable, I probably saw it on cable, and it was just, you know.
But the graphic sex in it, you know, early enough was enough to hook you for the rest of it.
I think Quest for Fire, if anything on the record, is filler. Or kind of.
Yeah,
just...
it's the second shortest. You know, clocking in at 3:42 on my version. Sun and Steel is 3:27.
Quest for Fire is pretty close to what a parody of Iron Maiden might sound like, so that's probably why it's not as appreciated, or it just feels, I don't know.
Nobody knew who they were or why they were looking for fire, but they knew they had to find it in this quest for fire.
And then we get to the next song, Sun and Steel, which I love this song, but it's another kind of pop metal version of Iron Maiden.
I think this is, you know, it's. I mean, after The Trooper, this is. This was written by Dickinson and Smith, but I think this is Harris's kind of most showy moment on the album, and I mean that in a good way. Like, the bass line is just beautiful on this, and it's his most prominent, just, you know, really carrying forward the melody, I think.
Yeah, so it's, I mean, it says it was based on...
Musashi. It was based on Musashi. He was a famous samurai who, I'm not going to say he invented it. Again, I wasn't there, I don't know. But he sort of pioneered the school of samurai sword fighting, in which you would hold two swords and fight with both of them at the same time.
Right.
And there are some really good books written about him. So again, if you don't know this stuff... It's a good education that you can get. Who's that Musashi dude? Well, go read this book, and you can learn a lot just through that keyhole, you know?
Yeah, I think I read that there was a Yukio Mishima essay or some kind of... something Yukio Mishima wrote about Musashi. Of course, Mishima has his own sword-related story, because he committed harikari famously, but... Yeah, Sun and Steel, it's weird. I mean, the first side, well, at least the first three songs are so epic, and then The Trooper is so amazing, but then these next three songs seem pretty simple and not as ambitious at all as the first three songs in the Trooper.
So. Yeah, you know, this is a time when metal was still reinventing itself. You know, when we're going from power metal and, you know, simple two guitar stuff to, you know, more epic material, stuff that thrash would pick up on so well with Metallica. You know, probably the pinnacle of that was Master of Puppets, and it was still possible to have some variety in the song length, pacing, the sequencing on the album. You know, this is one of those moments where metal kind of crystallized for a second and showed what was possible within the form, I think.
And then we get to the last song, which Steve Harris wanted to call it Dune, but Frank Herbert wouldn't let him, apparently.
Yeah, but he didn't mind getting that Hollywood money to make what they wound up making. Yeah.
But so if Steve Harris is going to call a song Dune, does he really need permission?
I don't know. Maybe they had a really conservative lawyer working for them who didn't want to risk it.
I think they wanted to use a reading. I think they wanted to open the song with, like, reading a passage from Dune. And that, I guess they would need permission for that. I don't even know if they'd need permission for that. They would need to probably pay him royalties, but I don't know.
There had been so many things to learn. Arrakis would be a place so different from Caladan that Paul's mind whirled with a new knowledge. Arrakis. Dune. Desert planet. Thufir Hawat, his father's master of assassins, had explained it. Their mortal enemies, the Harkonnens, had been on Arrakis 80 years, holding the planet in quasi-fief under a Chome company contract to mine the geriatric spice, Melange. Now the Harkonnens were leaving, to be replaced by the House of Atreides in fief complete, an apparent victory for the Duke Leto. Yet, Howard had said, this appearance contained the deadliest peril, for the Duke Leto was popular among the great houses of the Lansrot. A popular man arouses the jealousy of the powerful, Hawat had said. Arrakis. Dune. Desert planet.
Yeah, and I don't think the movie had been made yet. That was, you know, this was not like writing about a movie. You know, and in these last three, by the way, ding, 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 many Maiden checklist things. But, you know, at this point, he was writing about a classic science fiction novel. Yeah, 1984 was when the movie was released. So this is him writing about a science fiction book, not about a questionable David Lynch movie featuring Sting.
Yeah. Every song on this album references either a film, book, or historical figure, I guess, except Die With Your Boots On.
Yeah.
So, and Die With Your Boots On does kind of come across as the dumb song on the record. I guess it kind of doesn't fit in as much. But
yeah, not as literary, we'll say.
Yeah. But yeah, To Tame a Land is, to me, very indulgent. And, I mean, obviously, too many words. I always say that too many words, you can't have a melody with too many words. And to me, the lyrics of a song should serve the melody. I always think the best songwriting starts with a melody and then fits the lyrics to the melody. And when you're just going to write a shitload of words and just chant them over the music, that doesn't make for a good song. So that's a big problem with this song.
And this one, this is the longest one of the batch. I mean, this is 7:26. It clocks in on my version.
Yeah.
And Maiden would get longer. And as I said, I don't think it served them well.
No.
So this was also an indicator of trouble to come.
But, you know, interesting that this, it's not a hell of a lot longer than Where Eagles Dare or Revelations, but it sure feels a lot longer than those songs. I guess I probably made it all the way through this song if it was just playing in the background. But if I was, you know, very actively listening to this album, I would never even make it through this song. I would turn it off.
Yeah, this isn't one that I remembered vividly from those days. So no.
I had to go and listen to this song just to even remember what it was.
Because, yeah, if you have sound effects handy, just put in the stop of a cassette. Click. Yeah, well, hey, thank you so much for having me. You know, it's a great show you run here, and this is a great series. I've only heard the first one so far. When we were recording this, you've only released Martin Popoff's, and you couldn't have a better choice to start with. So I'm curious to see where it goes, because it's an epic tale. And as I said, I was wrong in turning my back on Maiden, maybe. I certainly respect where they are, what they've done, and what they continue to do.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ferris, for joining me. You told me to call you Ferris because I kept calling you DX, I remember.
It's okay.
And now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
So what we just heard was Iron Maiden covering I've Got the Fire by Montrose. That was the B-side to the Flight of Icarus single. Now we're going to hear Iron Maiden covering Cross-Eyed Mary by Jethro Tull. This was the B-side of the Trooper single. Till next time.
be back.